Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 178 of the Diddly Dum Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Pekka.
Mark, I had no idea you were a friend of Prince Harry's. Oh, sorry, you said Pekka. Who are you really, Pekka?
I'm Mark.
So, what's been happening since last we assembled? You heard about this tent? Someone set up a tent in the field behind my house. I don't know who it is. I mean, I've seen things like, you know, a campfire and a sleeping bag, but I haven't seen sight nor sound of the, you know, the actual,
camper.
Someone set up a tent in the field behind my house. I don't know who it is. I've seen things like a bone, a little campfire, and, ooh, a jolly little sleeping bag. But I haven't seen the sight nor sound of the tent owner. Anything else been happening?
In the world of Doctor Who, the only thing I've got to update on is that I am currently reading a Target novelisation, which I haven't read before, but I've had in my greasy little mitts for probably about 7 or 8 years now, and that is Battlefield by Mark Platt. When we did our Seventh Doctor retrospective, what was it, a year ago now, I think, I remember us all quite enjoying Battlefield, and when the Blu-ray came out, it was more watchable than all the other episodes I found on that season, because I think it was the one I watched the least when I was a kid, because I didn't have it when I was a kid, so that was easily explainable.
Yeah.
But it's a hidden gem, isn't it? I think it's so much fun, and the book is just as fun. It's Mark Platt who's written it, though, because Ben Aronovich, I think, disowned it. He was always a little bit embarrassed of what he did with Battlefield. So Mark Platt did the novelisation for this, but flicking to the front page, because I don't remember buying it, so I don't know how I got my hands on it. But then I flick to the very, very, very first page, and there's a signature there, which I think might explain that away.
Hmm.
Does anyone recognise the signature?
Oh, Chris Achilleos.
Oh, lovely.
It was Chris Achilleos gave this book to me.
Oh, jammy.
Very jammy. I think he gave this to me at the first Capital. Must have done, because he was, when I went to interview him at his house, he was drawing and painting the front cover to this, and The Visitation at the time, and Vengeance on Varos. He was working on those at the time that I went to his house and interviewed him. So, yes, that's it, really. I'm just really enjoying that book, and that's all I've been getting up to Doctor Who-wise, really.
Have you been out in your own book?
Not something I've done, but there was a report in the Daily Mirror newspaper a few days ago that apparently Stephen Tennant?
That man gets everywhere, doesn't he?
It's been reported that Stephen Moffat is coming back to write some episodes for RTD.
Of course!
Which has had some really weird reactions to it, because, I mean, considering he's written some of the very best episodes of Doctor Who. I mean, not all of his work's brilliant, but when he's good, he's very, very good. And indeed, he did a lot of great work under the showrunner Russell T. Davis, and perhaps I should put it a different way.
I can see why, Mark.
Yes, but yeah, there's been a strange reaction to it on the social media. I immediately saw people quote tweeting this article. Well, you don't know if it's true yet, but I saw people quote tweeting it, saying, "No, no, 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 no." This is people I follow as well. It's not like the usual sort of fringe nutters that I tend not to have in my feed, and some of the more normal people. But they were saying, "No, no, we don't want him. We don't want another white middle-aged straight guy writing Doctor Who. Get new people in." Well, for one, I mean, you've got Russell T. Davis is going to be writing a few episodes, surely, as we know. I don't see what the problem is, and he's one of the most successful writers, and also nobody knows who the other writers are going to be, who are going to be brought in yet. So to just say, no, 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 it's very odd behaviour, I think. And it's not always a great idea, is it, just to say, right, we're going to have a rule where we don't have any old writers in and stuff. Because J&T tried that, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just about to say that. Yeah.
And some of the best writing talent we've had in Doctor Who, then, well, didn't it? get to write again, you know.
I always find it funny when someone uses that expression, white, straight, middle-aged men.
Mm.
Because it's become such a cliche. As if actually their only problem is, let's say, there's not enough black writers, they'll say, oh, there's yet another white. And almost out of reflex, they'll just add, straight, middle-aged man. And invariably, when you see that, one of those that they've added without thinking completely makes their argument illogical. I mean, what exactly is our problem with his age?
I know.
If he's middle-aged, that's because he's been doing it so long he's been experienced. Do we particularly want someone who's 17 years old? Unless we find another Andrew Smith.
But yeah, like I say, this is people making these judgments without knowing who the other writers are who's going to be joining the show anyway.
Yeah.
It's just really odd, really odd. I'm disappointed in those people, frankly.
Have we heard the news about the, there's been some more wiping of tapes?
What?
Apparently, near the Diddly Dum Museum, there's been a big bonfire where Mark, Hayden and Doc were seen throwing old videos of Manchester United, Tottenham and West Ham games onto a big bonfire, trying to get rid of them forever. I don't know if anything's happened recently that's got them depressed a bit.
No. All right, let's move on.
Listeners with longer memories may recall, longer almost from back to our first few weeks of the podcast, Gary Whipp, who once chatted with us about the synopses, which used to be produced by the BBC and the Royal National Institute for the Deaf for deaf people, synopsizing, if that's a word, TV and radio shows, and which had belonged to Gary's Auntie Gertie, I think it was. In fact, as one of the first of our listeners to send such interesting memorabilia like this into us, I did check it on the, oh, that famous star-studded gala opening night of the Diddly Dum Museum. We actually hailed Gary as one of the inspirations for the very Museum concept, where guests would bring in Doctor Who memorabilia and we would chat about them. Now, I went back into, I went down into the Museum vaults to see if we still had these old copies of these synopses that Gary sent us. And I've got this old crate. Just got some of the Museum's robots to just bring it over. Pull it over here, will you, lads, please? Right, what were synopses? Here we are. These synopses are based on the scripts for rehearsals, so viewers should be prepared for slight variations on the final production. I thought, oh, that might be interesting. So I opened the first one, and I'm afraid I must have gone into a parallel universe, because I don't recognise this at all. In the, what looks like the second week of October 1980, we have them giving a synopsis of a forthcoming episode of a Doctor Who story, which I've never heard of. Episode 3 of The Last Zulfa Thuren, which suggests that they changed some of these working titles a lot later than we suspected they might have done. Saturday the 11th of October 1980. Romana tells Grugger that her ship landed on Tigella by mistake, and she offers to take him to it. Diedrich shuts down the power to all but essential services. They have 2 hours in reserve. Lexa tries to make the Doctor tell her what has happened to the pentagram. Clearly they decided, oh, let's have even more sides. Let's call it a dodecahedron. The Doctor says there are 3 possibilities. 1, the chronic hysteresis project, and it goes on and on and on. But rather interesting. And almost more interesting from what Mark and I have been chatting about recently. They're also, in 1981, synopsising all the episodes of To Serve Them All My Days, which is a fair, yeah.
Oh.
Bizarre coincidence. Anyway, Gary happened to be emailing us. While we, in our end credits, say if you want to contact us, do email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. I have to confess, listeners, that it's only about once every 3 or 4 months that I remember to check our inbox on Yahoo Mail. And I just purely by coincidence happened to check it a couple of days after Gary had emailed us in to draw our attention to some collections and of 2000 AD strips and 2000 AD graphic novels that Rebellion had brought out.
Ah.
Judge Dredd, Nicolai Dante, Slane, or Slonia, as I think we were taught to say it at the time. I think that's how, theoretically, how it would be pronounced in Irish. I'll put a link in the show notes at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. On the subject of which, our podcast, as of about a week ago, can now be found not only on platforms like iTunes and Stitcher.com, but also on Spotify.
Hey! This podcast is finally dipping a toe into the present.
It's very rare that we do anything approaching that.
Yes.
Thanks to some judicious prodding in our ribs by @Chuby123, who said, oh, it'd be much easier if it was on Spotify. And I was going to get a bit annoyed because I tried it. I was trying to do it for hours one night and I couldn't get it to recognise our podcast feed. And I thought, well, I'll just try it one more time. I went into some of our vital statistics. I told him it didn't recognise the podcast feed. I saw a different feed a couple of lines below, so I tried that and it immediately accepted it. So, if you fancy following us on Spotify, I think it's just diddly dumb. On the subject of which, by the way, I think I might have to ask the three of us, to re-record a recording of our final thing, because Audio Boom doesn't exist anymore.
Oh my god.
Spotify now exists, and I've realised that for the last about God knows how many months, every time we produce a new podcast on the block, I've been quoting our email address as diddlydumpodcast@diddlydumpodcast.
Ah.
So it's maybe why we've not been getting many emails from people. I've corrected that now. Right, have we anything to add before we go to... What was this Children of the Stones thing you were coming up with the other day, Mark?
Ah, yes. Well, I noticed on Bandcamp, I follow a folk horror account on Twitter, and they published a tweet, rather formally, and they had a link on there to Bandcamp, who were promoting on vinyl the music for Children of the Stones TV series, which we've discussed on here before, from the spooky children's TV series from the 70s, starring Gareth Thomas, amongst many others. And I managed to get hold of a copy. So I haven't broken the seal on it yet. It's still there, but it came with some freebies as well. Do you remember the slightly naff poster, painting that they look at, that tells the story of Children of the Stones, and it appears all the way throughout the TV series? Well, you get a poster of that, some little postcards. If I can just find it. Slightly disappointingly smaller than I'd hoped. An HTV sticker and a little fridge magnet, which I hoped was going to be bigger, saying,
"Happy day." That's tiny. Are you sure that's not a stamp?
I know. Yeah, it is slightly underwhelmed, but yes. So I was really pleased to get that. It's a limited edition of a limited pressing of 100. So I was really pleased to get my hands
on that. That's strange, isn't it? If you'd just asked me today, remind me where our introduction to the podcast every week, Happy Day, comes from, I would have completely forgotten. Is that where it was from?
Yes.
Is that what HTV stands for, in fact? Happy Day TV. That was ITV's Welsh franchise, wasn't it?
Wales and the West. Pretty much.
Does this actually stand for Harlech?
Yes.
Oh, right. Links in the show notes, as ever, listeners, at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Now, faithless listeners, did you guess from our choice of opening music for this podcast, and from Mark introducing himself as Packer, and also possibly from the fact that we've been flashing it all over Twitter for the last few days, that we're going to be following our recent retrospective of the Patrick Troughton era, we realised how much all three of us were fascinated by The Invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Written by Derek Sherwin from an idea by Kit Pedler. Do we see that on any other story? I thought, you know how, because two of the eight episodes are animated. When I first saw that, I thought, oh, that's something they put on new as part of the animation. And then when they went, we saw the original stories, it was on that as well. And I don't think I've ever seen that or anything, do we?
I'm just going to double check. I think it's on The Wheel in Space as well. I'm just going to double check that.
Oh,
one
right.
Second. It might be. So, The Wheel in Space was written by David Whittaker from a story by Kit Pedler.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's Kit Pedler again. So Kit Pedler comes up with the stories and then says, no, dear boy, I'm not going to actually write the story for you. What I'll do is I'll tell you what I want in it, and then you can go away and do it yourself, old chap, you right?
I don't think it went down that way, did it? I think they were like, this isn't really good enough, and it's certainly not long enough. We're going to have to rewrite the whole thing. Let's just use Kit for ideas, according to the making of documentary.
Pretty much, yeah.
So, yes, and Kit Pedler being a local boy to me, as he is now residing in the in that churchyard.
Of course!
Just a few miles away from me.
In that really worn, like, gravestone, isn't there? He's got a really worn gravestone.
Yeah. Yeah, it needs cleaning up.
Let's have a look.
I'd go and do it myself, but I'm not sure how it looks. Random person turning up to start cleaning random headstones in the church.
Well, yeah. No, that's true.
Might need permission.
Maybe you could say you were his wife. And then people wouldn't look. People wouldn't look at you twice, then.
No, that would look perfectly acceptable.
Back in September 2017, Mark, in our podcast 83, where we were reviewing
2017. God,
Mark visits Kit Pedler's grave.
Yeah, Mark, because I'd done it the few days before we recorded, I believe. So it was part of my Who news.
Previously.
I visited Kit Pedler today.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was JGB Sports. Kit Pedler.
No, I visited his grave, which is basically a few miles down the road in a little church in the countryside. Sounds ghoulish, but yeah, took a snapshot of his gravestone, which we can put a link to if people are interested. Although it's impossible to make out from it that it's Kit Pedler's because it's been untended and you can't actually make out any of the words on it unless you run your hands over the stone and sort of peer really closely. There's so much moss and lichen and stuff on it. It just simply says on it, Kit Pedler, 1927 to 1981, a man of vision. Which, considering he used to be an ophthalmologist, is quite appropriate.
I didn't realise that. Now, were you doing this intentionally, Mark, or was this purely coincidentally that you happened upon this grave?
No, I heard a few months ago that it was there, and I kept meaning to visit it. And
I thought it might be a bit of a coincidence.
Pay my respects, if you like. Yeah, I just I happened to be driving near there today, and I thought, well, you know, seeing as Kit Pedler's likely to come up in conversation, I thought I'd go and visit him and say good Lord.
Looking at the grave, I see what you mean about it being likened over. It's sort of ironic, that, isn't it? That Kit Pedler was sort of one of the arch technologists of Doctor who was sort of foreseeing the dangers in the bright, shiny plastic. And his gravestone is this sort of Victorian-looking...
Yeah.
Headstone all covered in mosses and it's in a little country churchyard under the open sky a mile away from.
Yeah, it took me quite a while to find it, obviously. I mean, you really can't hardly make out what it says on it.
No, well, as you say, the photo is not a low quality photo, but it's the stone is illegible on it. Barely make out the smiley face.
I don't think that's supposed to be a smiley face, but it does rather look like it, doesn't it?
Originally, It was going to be a 6-part story, apparently called Return of the Cybermen, in which the character of Professor Travers was to have appeared for a third time, but I think the decision was made to replace him with Professor Watkins to stop having to pay Mervyn Haseman and Henry Lincoln the right to use Professor Travers. And they were already against the usage of their character after a disagreement with the BBC over rewrites of the Dominators conducted without their approval.
Mm.
If they had to rewrite the Dominators, just how bad was it originally?
Yeah, without their consent, wasn't it? It was edited by Derek Sherwin and Terence Dix without the consent of Haseman and Lincoln, I think. And that's the reason why they got annoyed. But then I always thought, I mean, surely they wouldn't have been allowed to actually even mention Professor Travers. I thought there'd be something against that, because they owned the...
Well, there might be a rule about just mentioning.
Yeah.
I mean, if...
I don't know, is
there? You know, in school reunion, when Sarah and Rose are competing to what, you know, the best monsters they've seen. I've seen a lot less monster. I've met the, you know, the creator of the Daleks. I doubt they'd have to pay the Terry Nation estate for that, would they? Because if they actually had to feature them.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think the odd tossing of excuse expression.
Yeah, I imagine it's probably more if they appear on screen, isn't it?
Right, okay. Because, yes, because Travers is intellectual property, and I think Anne gets mentioned as well, doesn't she?
Mm, yes.
But for him to actually appear, it would have been...
Produced by Peter Bryant, directed by the president of the World Dudley Simpson Fan Club, Debbie Canfield, or possibly not. And famously, an 8-part series, which is still missing episodes 1 and 4, which were animated by, was it Cosgrove Hall?
Yes, yes it was, yeah.
Who would like to start us off?
I don't mind. The Invasion, I always remember being one of those stories that popped out off the page in the Television Companion book, which Howe and Stammers and... Or was it Howe? Yeah, Howe, Stammers and James Walker released in the late 90s, that great Bible of a book that I used to pore over and over again. And I actually saw it in a video shop when I was out. I remember this memory came back to me earlier on today with I was out with my cousin somewhere when we were kids, and I saw the video of The Invasion in the window of a shop, but didn't buy it. And it must have been the fact that I didn't have any money, or I don't even remember my mum being with us, so I don't even know if there's anyone around who had money on us. Don't remember where we were. All I do is I remember my cousin was there and I saw the video there. And the actual first time I ever saw it was when the DVD came out. And I remember being at school and seeing this, like, really ropey QuickTime video, which I think you could either download or you could click to watch on the Doctor Who website, which had the trailer for this, the trailer for the Cosgrove Hall animation. And it's the Cybermen in the rain outside St. Paul's. And the Doctor sort of looks up. It's a close-up on the animated... That's trans-animated face. Well, it was always animated, wasn't it? That was one of his quirks. And I remember being like, oh, I can't wait to see this. Cannot wait to see this. And it was actually one of the first DVDs I got for Doctor Who, because I think it came out, was it sort of mid-2006?
I'm already stunned at the news you were still at school when the animated DVD came out, Hayden.
Okay, so it was announced in 2006, so I'd have been in sixth form. And then when it came out on DVD, I'd have been working in my local pub. So I would have been able to afford it. And it was around this time that I bought not only The Invasion, but I also bought an Amazon exclusive John Pertwee set as well, which had 6 of his stories on DVD. And they were kind of like the ones that, I think, because I already have Remembrance, I already have Robots of Death, I already had The 5 Doctors, and possibly Spearhead from Space, because I remember they had the really poor front covers where it was just like a screenshot, wasn't it, from the story.
Mm.
So this is my first Patrick Troughton DVD. And I loved it. I absolutely adored it. I think his greatest strength, The Invasion, is something which lets down other stories, not just of, well, I wouldn't say of this era per se, but sort of eras after, subsequently, where, you know, with the Pertwee six-parters, a lot of them can be very hit and miss.
Hmm.
I think the thing that The Invasion does right is that it's got those 8 episodes, so it gives itself time to breathe. And it has to set the story up.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yes.
While the story has been set up and while the plot is running along as this sort of like mysterious sort of almost thriller half to it, that sort of episodes 1 to 4 before the Cybermen really do burst onto the scene, as they literally do. It gives time to meet the characters and to get to know the characters and to spend time in the company of the characters. And all of them are really, really likeable. It's a really strong ensemble. You know, I mean, obviously the big, probably the biggest star in this and probably the best guest star in this story. In fact, it's not probably he is the best guest star, is Kevin Stoney as Tobias Vaughn, who is just excellent. Absolutely. And that sort of, he has a very cold and maniacal approach to the character, but loses his rag quite a lot. I seem to remember with Packer, sort of, as the story goes on, he gets more and more desperate and loses his, just loses his temper more and more as the situation gets further and further out of his grasp. And of course, Peter Halliday as Packer is a very good sidekick. Also, he played the cyber director as well, which I didn't realise until literally Wikipedia in the show earlier on tonight.
Well, you can imagine why he might have tried to cover it up, considering how inaudible it is, can't you?
Well, it's literally, I reckon he's just sat there, kind of doing out with his lips, saying, it has been agreed.
Oh, geez, that was quite good, try that again.
It has been agreed. There we go.
That's excellent.
Oh, Mark, I think we might have a new character living in the Hoosium until the end of time.
Sally Faulkner as Isabel, I really like her. It gives Zoe a friend. It gives Zoe someone to feed off. So you don't have Zoe or Jamie playing the awkward third wheel in that I mean, they don't, but you know what I mean? They could do, but give someone for her to go off and have an adventure with and need rescue in.
Hayden, when you say that you like her, you man! What exactly do you mean?
Oh, of all the big-headed, chauvinistic...
anti-feminist. I mean, such a word as anti-feminist.
Yeah, anti-feminist. It was a calming for me to see that Edward Burnham's hair is about 99.9% calmer than what it is in Robots.
Oh, this was extraordinary. Do you know, I was watching it for the first time in ages, and I was thinking, oh, God, doesn't he look like him? I wonder if he was the original inspiration for Professor Kettle, or doesn't he look like him? I had no idea it was him. But he does, doesn't he? It looks as if he's it's just allowed it to grow over the intervening years.
Yeah, he really... within the eight years, was it? 8 years between... No, 6 years between this and that. And, of course, you know, this is the return of Nicholas Courtney as Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart this time. And it never occurred to me before, but this is the same uniform he and the unit men are wearing as they do in season 7, isn't it?
Yeah, when he interviews Liz to join the unit.
That's it, yeah. It's such a brilliant concept. And it's the fact that it plays out like it is a series. It's not a serial, as it were. It's like, it could be something like Happy Valley. It's a 6-part self-contained series. That's kind of how this feels for me.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Because you get the chance to know these characters, which is interesting because this is around the time that Patrick Troughton and Fraser Hines had complained to the production team that they were exhausted. So they'd reduced the episode run times from 25 minutes to about 23. And 6 of the 8 episodes of this are 23 minutes long.
Well, doesn't Wendy go on holiday on episode 3?
She goes on holiday in episode 3.
Like Bill used to do. And then Fraser's on a break during the final episode, which possibly fits into that, yeah.
And you don't really miss him as well in that last episode because there's so much going on. And it allows Zoe to obviously come to the fore as well. But it's odd that you'd schedule for one of your main cast members to go on a holiday in the last episode.
Or if you ask those unit soldiers, it just allows Zoe to come to the rear somewhat.
Oh, well. Yeah, we'll get on to that, shall we?
Yeah.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I can't believe... I know they've been going for a while, but I cannot believe that the first of the animations happened 17 years ago. And just 1 year after New Who came back.
Oh, it's half my life ago.
God, I'm old.
Half my life ago. I was 17 when The Invasion came out on DVD. Yeah, utterly insane. But it was brilliant. It was revolutionary, and the animation really suits this story, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because Cosgrove Hall is such a... Well, obviously, to be honest, until BBC Studios got involved, and arguably still, this is probably still the most lauded and well-known animation company to actually be involved in the animations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the animation, what Cosgrove Hall have done really well is they've kept it basic, actually.
Mm.
You know, when you're watching some of the some other animations and they repeat frames or they cheat, and you can tell that, oh yes, they cut those people off there so you don't have to see their legs, blah de blah. They're repeating that movement. But Cosgrove Hall make it look, well, you don't notice it as much. And I think it's very basic, but it looks brilliant. It does suit the story loads. It's because they managed to make it atmospheric as well. And that's
They do.
The thing. It really suits the tone of the series.
I think I saw it. You mean that would be more a series than a serial, Hayden? Because if you think of some of the normal four-parters, they do just come across as a single story that they've inserted three cliffhangers in, haven't they?
Mm.
Whereas you do actually think this is, you know, a part one, part two, as opposed to an episode one, episode two.
Yeah, because you get that thing with they're being followed around by a couple of guys in that car.
Yeah.
And you don't know who those guys are.
Mm.
And, you know, it's not until halfway into the second episode that you find out that they're unit people. But at the time, they seem sinister as well.
Yeah, they do.
It's just one of those things. So there's these things going on, and you're right, there's all these mysteries, and it does give you that time to get to know the characters and to watch the characters and like you said, Hayden, they are all very likable. I love all of them. Tobias Vaughn is incredibly likable. That's obviously down to Kevin Stoney's, the wonderful Kevin Stoney's acting. His voice is just honey, isn't it? It's wonderful. I could listen to it for ages. He's such a good actor as well. It's the way he does that, charming and urbane and relaxed, and yet underneath him there's this, and you just think, who's this guy? There is that sort of like sinister undertone to his performance.
Yeah.
And then when he loses his rag with Packer, another one of Packer's incompetent things, and he explodes and screams in his face, it's just brilliant. That switch to rage, I think it's in episode 3, where he's just been chatting away. I think one of his lines that sums up the character as well of Tobias Vaughn is,
"They can't harm us, Packer. We're in control. Or at least I am."
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. He's a control freak. It's all about control for him, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, he doesn't like the way planet Earth is run, and he thinks it'd be much better if it was under his control. And the way that mania for it starts leaking out more and more as his plans unravel towards the end. Just brilliant. Going right up until that.
"I'll help you to destroy them because I hate them. They destroy my dream."
In episode 8, it's just brilliant.
The way he talks to the cyber director.
Mm.
The cyber director could kill him at any moment. Mm. Especially since he's part cybernetic. And yet he stands in front of that door and that weird sort of mechanical creatures behind it. And the creature will be saying, you know, "We were Bumblebee. We were raiding in 7 days' time. No, we have to do it today. It has been agreed." You know, and that's just, it's...
He's like Gary Lineker dealing with the BBC, isn't he?
Oh.
Tobias Vaughn.
Hang on, which one's Gary Lineker?
The BBC would be the cyber director.
Yeah.
Because from episode 4 onwards, there's a lot of people with these big ear-like things coming out. Oh, they're Cybermen, aren't they? Sorry.
Oh, bless.
Yeah, considering how dangerous the cyber director's supposed to be, you would have thought that Tobias Vaughn and Packer would have waited for the door to close on it before they started bitching about it at one point.
Yeah, I know. They just don't care, do they?
No.
There's a real anarchy going on there. It's something I also liked about, because obviously Tobias Vaughn is part cybernized, I thought that Kevin Stoney's obviously got a lazy eye.
Yeah.
And there's moments where, to me, I thought, my God, that's astonishing. He's sort of shutting down. He's showing that as he's losing control, that eye's closing. And I thought that was to do with the part of the cybernization of him and the fact that he's sort of fighting against control within him.
Right.
And then I discovered, no, he just had a lazy eye. Well, all right, okay. put my theory to pot, though. Another actor in this, James Thornhill, who played Sergeant Walters. I took one look at him this time and I thought, good God, it's Fluff. He looks like Alan Freeman's little brother.
Yes. Yes, I
do. The one who gets killed off camera by Benton in between episode 7 and 8 so that Benton could be the focal point in the in the plane at the end. I do feel we do have to talk about that, actually. Sergeant Benton turning up in... well, Sergeant Benton at this point, is he?
No, Corporal.
Corporal Benton yeah. at this point, yeah. He's it's really odd seeing... When you watch Doctor Who out of synchronicity and when you're watching it for the first time, you know, I saw... The Android Invasion was my second classic Doctor Who story, and that's Benton's last appearance. And I think The Invasion was probably the last one I saw, even though it was his first. And it was really bizarre, because the bit in the car, it was only on this repeated viewing I realised it was Benton in the car.
Oh.
On the animation.
Oh, the two guys in the sports car.
Yeah. Who were tracking the Doctor and Jamie.
Yeah, following them around.
But then in the second part, I thought, yeah, he's one of the heavies who brings him in. Who brings them into the Brigadier. And I thought, well, that's crazy. You know, what's Sergeant Benton doing there? Of course, he plays a more prominent role towards the end, but...
And I also wonder, does John Levine get more lines in this story than in the whole of the rest of Doctor Who altogether? Admittedly, it's mostly, hello, hello, Roger, Roger.
Yeah, unit control calling the Brigadier. Unit control calling the Brigadier. He gets a lot towards the end. I think Douglas Canfield was a big fan of him, wasn't he?
Oh, really? Were they?
But yeah, Douglas Canfield took a shine to him, so wanted him in, yeah. But it's interesting, because Douglas Canfield... promoted Nicholas Courtney to Lethbridge Stewart. He was originally supposed to play Captain Knight.
That's right, yeah.
And then he promotes John Levine from being a Yeti in The Web of Fear, which was the previous story that he worked on, to being more prominent here. And I think, was it the James Thornhill was ill and couldn't make the recording on episode 8? So then that's when John Levine stepped in with more lines and took his line. That's the line saying, oh, Sergeant Walters is looking after the Geneva connection. Which sounds like an amazing new wave band from the early 80s.
We have sick leave policies like that at work. If you're feeling a bit ill, you get shot off soon.
You can just see Annie Nightingale on the Old Grove Institute saying, and now with their number one hit, introducing Sergeant Walters and the Geneva Connection.
Speaking of UNIT, is this one of the best uses of UNIT? Or if not, possibly the best? Because... they look like a proper, serious military outfit.
Mm.
They're much better equipped, aren't they, than they ever are again?
Oh, God, yes. That moment when the car drives onto the airstrip, drives around, then over to the back of the plane. I was beside myself with joy watching that this time round. It's just such a delight. And I think that's such a great idea to have that plane as their base of operations as well for it. And the Brigadier is... very much in control, isn't he, as well? Mm. And like I say, they just look like they mean business. And not only that, they come across as being truly, properly international with her Brigadier getting in touch with other people and, oh, I've spoken to Russia, oh, I've spoken to Geneva. You know, it never feels quite as... Sometimes I think UNIT, especially in the Pertwee years, can be quite insular, can't it? Whereas this feels like UNIT go out across the world, you know.
It's probably the most universal, I think, UNIT ever get, yeah.
Well, they've constantly got the Third Doctor putting the Brigadier down, haven't they? Once he becomes Buffoon Brigadier.
Yes.
About halfway through the Pertwee years. Actually, once they dump that made-for-measure UNIT uniform and just take on a normal British Army uniform, that tends to be the cut-off point, doesn't it, where we're allowed to treat the Brigadier seriously prior to that, but after that... the Doctor's constantly, and he's saying silly things like, oh, I'm pretty sure that's Cromer. I mean, when you say they're better equipped than ever before, we're not talking about fake moustaches, are we?
No.
Well, I think when it comes to UNIT action sequences, I think the final episode, the fight between UNIT and the Cybermen, is outstanding. I love that. And I have to say as well, one of my favourite moments, and it always gets repeated, every time there's a Doctor Who clip compilation or whatever, they always include the bit with them. Troughton running away from the Cybermen as explosions go off behind him. But the juxtaposition of the humour in that is the fact that Tobias Vaughan's corpse is swinging backwards and forwards in the background. Yes. And if you're just to concentrate on that, it's quite creepy. But then immediately after you get a really cool moment when the Brigadier orders for a bazooka to be fired at the Cybermen, blows them up, and then the Doctor's on the floor, and then Isabel starts taking his picture, and he just and then he just gives in, and he just starts posing for her, and like tucks his hair up, and it's just brilliant, brilliant moment.
Yeah, Patrick Troughton has some great little moments like that throughout this story as well, doesn't he? Like, there's the bit in the alleyway where he's trapped at either end by these mysterious people, and him and Jamie just sit down on that step and start playing cards. Oh, obviously, the old going down into the sewers and tossing the coin and then walking in the opposite direction. And even bits like when he's just working on the circuitry and stuff, he's looking through a microscope and things, and he's working on the circuitry at the start of one of the episodes, and the camera's just sort of on him, and he's not doing anything much, but it's still really watchable. It's just great. You're just watching him, and he's just, this is great.
Even him and Jamie tucking into some sandwiches, and then Jamie turning on the radio and just sort of, Jamie, down and down. I love that. Their chemistry at this point is just, it is throughout the run, isn't it? But it's just so telepathic. Oh. It's brilliant.
Yeah, Jamie saying to him, "You're a canny wee man."
Yeah.
It's just lovely.
And doesn't he say, because Jamie has a nap, doesn't he, through one of the episodes? Mm. And then they all converge for the Doctor to give an update. And the Doctor kind of goes, "Oh, you're with us, are you, Jamie?" Or something like that he says to him, and it's quite like...
"Oh, how do you do, Jamie?"
Oh, I love it. This might actually be Zoe's best story, I think, as well.
I think it probably is, yeah.
She's so proactive in this. Obviously, she helps the troops to blow up the spaceship. She's there, walking around, owning it as well. Like, those pictures of... that live long in my memory from, like, old Doctor Who magazine copies back in the day. Pictures of the Brigadier and Isabel and Zoe standing over dead Cybermen. And Isabel sort of taking pictures and stuff. And Zoe just sort of commands that. She's as commanding as the Brigadier somehow in those images. And they're sort of burnt in my mind from when I was younger. And, I think she's brilliant. Blowing up the computer's excellent. And they're sort of sitting down and sort of like taking delight in what she's just done. And Isabel says, "Haven't we better go since we've just blown up their security computer?" "Oh, yeah, you're right, we better go." She allows herself a little victory in that just before they scarp her. Now, I think they're excellent. They're so, so good. And you can kind of tell this was the start of a new production block. This was the start of the 6th season production block, because the Mime Robber had been filmed at the end of the previous one.
Oh, right.
So there's a freshness to the cast as well, even though, like we said in our previous episode, they didn't get a lot of time off. And it's probably helped that they're on location. They're filming at a Guinness factory. So Tobias Vaughan's, the electrical company, the International Electromatics.
International Electromatics.
Electromatics, that's it, sorry, yeah. It was filmed at a Guinness factory. And some of the scenes that were filmed on location were filmed after lunch, where Pat and Fraser are half cut. And it's more noticeable in episode 3. When they're on the roof, where Patrick's hair's sort of all over the shop, and he looks half asleep when he's looking around. It's so funny. Really funny.
As I said before, they are one of my all-time favourite TARDIS teams. They just look like brilliant. They're having such good fun together.
Mm.
The chemistry between them is superb, like you say. Zoe's particularly good in this story, because she's got such agency. And it just really suits her character to meet this kind of hip 60s chick and be like, "Oh, this is interesting. Oh, this is fun. What a jolly old time we're having." And I love the fact that they pair her up with Isabel, and off they go and do their stuff. And like you say, blowing up the computer, and then later on going down into the sewers and what have you. And it's just absolutely brilliant. And of course, it's that. Zoe gets her Mind Robber catsuit out again, doesn't she?
Mm.
And it's funny, because when she's in missile control and she's reading out her sums, which helped take down the whole cyber fleet, rather than just a few spaceships, she works out a few quick, easy sums. "Right, you got to do this, do this." And she walks along telling these individual missile operatives what to do. And as she stood between two of them at one point in her catsuit, you just clearly see one of them just leans slightly back in his chair and just has a little peep down at her bum. And pulls a sort of slightly, face.
Yeah.
Just fairly blatant, wasn't it?
It was. It's hilarious.
Surprised he didn't ask for a number while they were filming. I kind of hope that was just an ad lib, because I don't know how I'd feel if Douglas Canfield had said to the extra, "Tell you what you should do is you should go check out her bum while she walks past. It's,
it does look almost like it's involuntary. Do you know what I mean? It's like that. Yeah. Oh, I didn't realise I was doing it from the actor.
Maybe.
But who knows?
Maybe.
Who knows?
Just going back to another, there's a set piece that didn't take place in this story, which was the car ambush.
Yeah.
Where they wrestle back Professor Watkins. I really wish we could have seen that. And I know Ian Marta's novelisation of the book reinstates that, and it just sounds really exciting. And I would have loved to have seen, if they had the time and the budget to film it, you know, to see the likes of Captain Turner and Benton and, you know, Packer and Gregory and Professor Watkins all in this fight. Two other little scenes I want to mention, sorry, before I hand the mic over to Doc and, or before I hand the conch back to Doc and Mark. The scene in the office between Professor Watkins being goaded into shooting Vaughn is really well played. Really well played.
Yeah, I know.
Love that.
It's such a pity that he mentions beforehand Vaughn, about 10 minutes earlier, I've got a cybernetic body, but my brain is still my own.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Because if we hadn't known that, he could have shot him. We thought, God, how could he be still alive? And then we would have realised, possibly without them even having to tell us he'd been cybernized. But it's extraordinary, isn't it?
And the second one I just wanted to mention as well was the cliffhanger to episode 6, where that electronic sound is just roaring through London. And you've got, it's Derek Sherwin, isn't it? Derek Sherwin as an extra with his face planted on the steering wheel of the car with his eyes open like this. It was just like, obviously it culminates in the Cybermen walking down St. Paul's Cathedral, which for years was one of the most iconic, probably still is, one of the most iconic images in Doctor Who history. But it's such an exciting cliffhanger. It comes in episode 6, like I said, where, you know, this is just episode 6. You've still got 2 episodes to resolve this, and it just doesn't, it doesn't feel like it's, it feels like it's taking its time to breathe, like I said earlier, this story. And it's opening these moments up, and it's not chucking them in just the final episode and it's a bit of a rush, or they're not, you know, making this very top heavy. Don't see the Cybermen until the cliffhanger in episode 4. It's just incredible. No. I mean, can you imagine if they did that now? If they did a longer story, let's say a 3-parter, where the big bad isn't revealed until the end of episode 2, let's say. It's just, it's extraordinary. But, oh yeah, the scene in the sewers between Jamie, Isabel and Zoe and the Cybermen, and then the policeman gets shot. I mean, there's never any, I think if this episode was made now, more of a deal would be made out of the fact that the companions got an innocent man killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of glossed over, isn't it?
Yeah. Very much so, yeah.
Captain Jimmy Turner's sort of like, oh, don't worry about it, it's fine.
Yeah. At least you're safe.
Do you want to come to dinner?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Oh, here comes my dolly soldier.
Well, the Brigadier tells them, doesn't he? You're a young woman, this is a job for my men. She does a, well, of all the bigoted anti-feminist critics' remarks. And you're thinking, the very idea that Brigadier should challenge the inalienable right of a woman in the 60s to be groovy. And then they go and get someone killed.
Yeah.
2 people killed.
And they seem to quiet down after that, don't they?
But acting from a purely military viewpoint, the Brigadier is thinking, well, we can't put these people in danger.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Not necessarily because she's a woman, but because she's a civilian.
Yeah, and he says it to the Doctor and Jamie as well. Yeah. You know, I think it's the bit when when he takes the helicopter in episode 3, is it? Says, you know, you get in and out of there and my men will circle, but, you know, I think there's more of a reluctance with Jamie being with him than there is the Doctor. I think he trusts the Doctor to get on with it. But I think when it comes to Jamie, you know, this is someone who's young, and these 2 young girls as well going down into the sewer, putting themselves in danger.
Now, wait a minute. This is hardly a job for you.
Oh, I ever not.
Well, you're a young woman. This is a job for my men.
Well, of all the bigoted, anti-feminist, cretinous remarks...
This is no job for a girl like you. Now, that's final.
Oh, you... you man...
It's a bit like saying in the 1960s, it's a sign of what a sexist and unequal society we live in, that 90% of neurosurgeons are men, which may well have been true. So to counteract this anti-feminism, we're going to let this fashion photographer perform your brain operation, which will probably be silly.
And there's a funny irony with it that in the end, the pictures that she takes look like they would be faked pictures. It reminded me of like the Bigfoot pictures or the Loch Ness Monster photos. They're just blurry and very not very well done. And then she just kind of storms off, doesn't she?
Well, there's a future story written in the Wilderness Years where she tries to sell those to the world's media.
Oh.
And she just gets internationally ridiculed because they just look so fake. Apparently. I think Tobias Vaughan makes it. Because really, if you think about it, I mean, I think the... Is it the cyber planner or the cyber director in the cupboard?
The cyber director, I think.
The cyber director and the cybermen are pretty inaudible. But you don't really care, do you? Because Tobias Vaughan, the cybermen just take second place to him, don't they? And clearly they're doing his plan as well. They're not. He's not, you know, someone who's just... he's there to help them invade the Earth. He's quite clearly planning to get rid of them once they've put him in power. But he's got proper Bond-level villainy, hasn't he? And like you say, because they give us enough room to breathe, they give him enough room to just say silky little things like that. Packer, what are you doing? And it just, it all looks good, even though it's black and white. It's possibly, it looks good because all the permittedly repeated and repeated rockets being fired off don't actually look like stock footage just crowbarred in, do they? You know how the rocket in the Revenge of the Cybermen is clearly...
Oh, yeah, it's the Saturn V, isn't it?
Just a bit they've borrowed off NASA.
Yeah.
It just looks good, even though it is black and white. The animation's pretty good. I mean, apart from the fact that throughout, Jamie looks as if he's wearing a cauliflower around his neck, which I think they could have done a bit better with that. I love the 1960s streets and alleyways were quite Sweeney-ish.
Yes.
I thought at first that the Electro People HQ in London was Centrepoint, but it's actually Milbank Tower, I think. And there is a lot of needless to-ing and fro-ing between the HQ in London and the bigger factories in the southeast of England. But I don't think you really mind, do you? Because if they were trying to do that in a four-parter, you'd be thinking, oh, stop messing around, we're losing a lot of decent stuff. But you can take it at your leisure. I don't think it feels that padded, apart from the occasional moving back and forth. I thought it's a pity that... Obviously, it's a pity that episode one's missing. But how quickly that lorry driver just gets shot.
I know, yeah.
Just out of hand. And that's quite shocking, that. Even in a series, it's not the first time that people get shot in Doctor Who. But it just seemed quite shocking for some reason. But... And the other reason why it's a pity episode one got lost is that when they leave behind the lorry driver, the car driver who just stops to give the Doctor, Zoe and Jamie a lift into London, with the car was being driven by Dougie Canfield.
Oh.
Which I thought was a bit interesting.
I noticed the number plate on that car is, I think it's on the car, is H2363, which are both very powerful Whovian numbers.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know what to say, actually, because the two of you have mainly said it. The story marks Terence Dick's debut, isn't it? As his first credited contribution to the series. And was he also script editor for this? Yes, he was. He was script editor.
I've got a feeling. Was it... Do you mean the first time he was credited? Is that what you said?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Can I just double-check that? Because I remember him saying, when I first joined the programme, the thing I remember they were doing was trying to make a Yeti sound less like a flushing laboratory. So let me just double-check.
Yeah, do you know what I remember him saying that? Because I just heard him.
I'm just double-checking. I'm just going through the computer databanks here. I think you're right. I think Derek Sherwin was the script. I think he must have tailed Derek Sherwin. And then going forward, yeah, you're right, Doc. Yeah, you're right. Sorry.
I think it's interesting talking about the focus being put on Zoe's bum. That when they're escaping up the lift shaft after climbing out of the lift up the ladder, the Doctor makes clear to say, I'll go up the ladder first in front of Jamie. He just doesn't want to be looking up as he's going up the ladder to see a pair of hairy, well, shall we say?
See Jamie's haggis.
Yeah, oh dear, oh dear. Dear, oh dear.
Well, because he was having to... do a lot of this action himself, going up on to the helicopter, the dresser sewed lead weights into his kilt to make sure it stayed down so it didn't blow up, because he normally wore football shorts underneath his kilt because he used to play football with the cast and crew during their break times.
The music's quite almost film noirish at times, I think. What, any idea what Douglas Camfield's problem with Dudley Simpson was?
I've got no idea.
Is it people used to keep getting their first names mixed up or something?
Possibly. I don't know. It's a strange one, isn't it?
I think it's quite established, isn't it, that he wouldn't work with Dudley Simpson.
Mm.
So he used Don Harper, who's another Australian composer, which is strange, because his objection to Dudley Simpson can't have been that he's an Australian, which you would think would be someone's automatic problem, wouldn't you? And so, any thoughts on the music?
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. Mm. Like I said, very film noir, almost sort of it crests fiery to me.
Mm.
Sort of very spy thriller.
Yeah.
Really, really good.
Yeah, there's a bit of military-style music, isn't there, at the end?
Hmm.
But they don't use a lot of music during this entire story. A lot of the time, there's no music at all. Normally, with Dudley Simpson, you get Dudley Simpson lights all over the place. Whereas I don't think Don Harper's stuff is anywhere near as intrusive. Not that I have a problem with Dudley Simpson at all, but I'm just pointing out. And so there isn't much music, but I noticed there's a lot of what you call diegetic sound, which is sort of electronic humming and stuff and things that are coming from what's happening on scene, so from what's happening in the scene. So you get all this buzzing and machine noises, like as a constant sort of tone in a lot of places, which kind of keeps the tension going. And you just get you get a few short stabs of music occasionally, but yeah, on the whole, it's not. But that main piece of Don Harper's that they use is really nice. It's very sort of, it's a bit kind of Get Carter theme tune, slightly that sort of.
Oh, God, it is, isn't it?
And it's just great, brilliant work by him. Did you know he's been sampled by MF Doom, Danger Mouse and Gorillaz?
Oh, I like, well, two of them I really like, so that's good. Oh, brilliant.
I think that's out of my experience, those names.
Well, Don Harper also composed the theme tune to World of Sport, which was anchored by the recently departed Dickie Davis.
Wasn't that, dum dum dum, dum 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 dum. Was that one?
Yes, that's the one.
Maybe not quite like that. And also, in 1973, he actually rearranged the Doctor Who theme music, didn't he?
Oh.
On an album called Homo Electronicus, which sounds suspiciously to me like what must be Latin for electro people. So, I don't know if he inspired Kenny Everett at all. We may well play out at the end of this podcast over the full recording of that. A lot of this is it's expanded. I know I very rarely have read anything that was published, any of the fan fiction that was published during the Wilderness years. But we get this issue, don't we, where the Doctor is, they say, oh, we recognise him on Planet 14.
Hmm.
which apparently was supposed to be, according to David Banks in a book called Iceberg, was originally supposed to be the 14th planet of our solar system that some faction of Cybermen left Mondas for. But then it was in the World Shapers, in the comic strip, Planet 14 was supposed to be Marinus, wasn't it? And when didn't all the Vord...
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Marinus become an early Cyberman.
Yeah, Grant Morrison wrote that, didn't he?
And then, it's all right, taking things a bit far, in a book called Original Sin, at the moment of his death, Tobias Vaughan's consciousness was transmitted via satellite into one of 14 identical robot copies of himself. Well, I don't know if that makes you groan, but it does me a bit. And he starts infiltrating the government. And over the centuries, he's apparently these robot versions of Tobias Vaughan manipulated history to bring about things like the boss computer in Green Death. The development of the, what was the time scoop used in? I don't mean the Death Zone time scoop. The one in Carnival of Monsters. And even Professor Kettle's K1 robots, which just seem to be this very sort of fan-wanky idea that everything has got to be linked in with everything else. That was in a book called The Scales of Injustice. Oh, dear. Back it was written by Gary Russell. Interesting that he should, in theory, have invented the development of the boss computer, Stevens, because in the same way that Zoe talks the answer phone computer into madness, that's what the Doctor does to Boss, isn't he?
Mm. Yes.
Yes, but Wendy Padbury isn't in episode 3 because she's on holiday. And Fraser, I was wondering where he was. He says, oh, he's all right. He's just having a checkup at the hospital. And I was thinking, I didn't realise he'd gone. But he's clearly on a break or something. But the thing is, in the final episode, where's Jamie? Oh, he's all right. He's just having a checkup at the hospital. We'll pick him up on the way. Well, I'd be careful if I were you, Fraser, because that's what they told Jackie Lane.
Oh.
Nice that there was a comedy like where Jamie, they make him get into Tobias Vaughan's Rolls Royce and he just gets out the other end.
Yes.
Like, you know, like a clown car and gets in the front seat.
Is that a Beatles homage?
Yes, it could be, couldn't it?
That one of their films.
You're right about that final units battle in the final episode, although they're not actors. There's actually a company of soldiers that the army lent them. It's probably, you know, why those two jeeps just turned up full of soldiers.
And that big truck behind them.
I very much doubt that they got paid anything. I do think that solving everything with missiles seems a bit of a letdown. But do the Doctor really need to be there? Other than Zoe, you know, be able to program them to go all in the best directions or the missiles. I'm not sure if the Doctor's really needed there. Is it all they need to do is just, when the Cybermen started invading, Cybermen are going to invade. Oh, let's just fire our Earth missiles at them.
Yeah, but there's nobody there to fire the missiles, was there, unless the Doctor got involved? Because he was the one who created the signal blocker, which blocks the signal which was knocking people out.
Oh, of course, I suspect. I may well have nodded off at several times during while I was watching this. Because I did think, and they said, oh, Johnny, what's he called? Jimmy, whatever the captain was called. And they're saying, oh, yeah, he's halfway to Russia by now.
Jimmy Turner, yeah.
I said, Russia? What? I don't remember that bit. So I think I might have nodded off at that point.
Aww.
Jimmy Turner is played by Robert Sidaway here. I really like his little blossoming relationship with Isabel as well. I think it's really sweetly done and it's not over-egged. And that's, again, sort of seems to develop slowly as the series goes on to me. And I really like that bit.
He played Avon in The Savages, apparently. Which may well be one of the last two Doctor Who episodes I've never actually seen in any format whatsoever. So let's see, well, I mean, Kevin Stone, we've mentioned, probably most famous to us as playing Thrasyllus in I, Claudius. I didn't know this, but in 1985, the fan magazine DWB, was that Bulletin for the B?
Yeah, Dreamwatch Bulletin, as they became, it started off as Doctor Who Bulletin and became Dreamwatch, didn't it?
That notorious fanzine reported that Kevin Stoney had died at the age of 64. But in 2 years later, he made an appearance at a Doctor Who convention, much to the shock of fans who assumed he was dead.
Oh, no.
Kevin Stoney eventually died in 1993 on his 87th birthday. But at next month's Capital 6 convention, he will make an appearance to astonish fans everywhere. Major Brownwell was played by Clifford Earle, who was also had a role in Dalek's Master Plan. He was also, Hayden, this will perk you up, he was the immigration officer in Diamonds Are Forever. You know when they come out
of
the hovercraft station and a guy comes out and says, "Oh, Mr. Franks, there's a phone call for you." I think it must
that's
be him.
And then
Moneypenny comes out dressed in a customs uniform. Now, here's something that I found interesting. In 1953, at the age of 19, Clifford Earle was among a group of servicemen who... How daft you have to be. Who volunteered... Hang on, is he still alive? Okay. Who volunteered to take part in experiments at Porton Down, which is the British Army's military chemical warfare research centre. Experiments which he believed were related to the common cold, but in fact involved exposure to nerve agents such as sarin. And several of these other servicemen died after exposure to these. And in 1999, when the police began an operation to investigate these experiments, Clifford Earle founded the Porton Down Veterans Support Group. In his life, he suffered from spinal problems, prostate cancer and other illnesses. But on the plus side, he never did actually catch the common cold. So,
What? I think that's a joke.
They told him, "Oh, take part in these experiments. It's about curing the common cold."
I've got one more thing. The look of the Cybermen in this story was never replicated before. I mean, you have similar heads to the ones that are up in Revenge of the Cybermen.
Yeah.
But this is the Cybermen story that closes the chapter on the metal monsters from Mondas. On the 60s, they're not in Doctor Who again until 1975, which is a really long time to go until Revenge of the Cybermen. They turn up twice as like visions. The one in The Mind of Evil is seen very, very briefly when the Keller machine is basically trying to kill the Doctor. And then there's one that appears on the miniscope in Carnival of Monsters,
yeah.
And that's it. So the Pertwee doesn't see the Cybermen at all in his main run. Obviously he does later with the Five Doctors, but you know. This look of the Cybermen, where does it kind of rate for you?
Oh, this is my favourite.
Is it?
This is my favourite Cybermen.
It's my favourite, because it's the first one I came across, yeah.
Okay. This is the one I have as an action figure from Character Option, so this is one I quite like as well.
This must be where they got the Cyberman mask for in the museum in Dalek, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Death in Heaven as well.
Is this your Croton Character Options figure, Aidan?
No. No. The Croton, the Cyberman, was a Daypole figure from the 90s, whereas this other one is currently residing up in the loft with the rest of the Character Option dollies, as it were. No, it wasn't. No, this is a completely different figure. But no, I really like this look. I love the Mondasian Cybermen look. Actually, do you know what? I'm not a big fan of the Wheel in Space Cybermen, but I think this is probably third favourite for me, Cyberman look, behind the Moonbase Cybermen, or Moonbase and Tomb Cybermen, and the 10th Planet. And then I'd say it's the Invasion Cybermen.
I've not really liked much from Earthshock onwards. I've not really liked them that much.
No.
Although the voices are very much improved. Excellent.
Also, on the subject of the Cybermen, I guess in this one, there's less... they don't have to do anything particularly, do they? They haven't got the personalities, so to speak, in inverted commas, that some of the other Cybermen do. They you know, you don't get to hear them talking, you just get to hear them screaming, basically.
Mm.
I mean, I guess in a way they appear more robotic, although not as robotic as they do in the RTD era. But I still like that. I like the fact that they're sort of silent, daunting, you know, towering figures just stomping around. Well, they don't even stomp, do they? They just march normally. I like that.
They do get a little easily killed by the emotion machine, don't they? It's almost like just wave a little bit of gold vaguely in their direction and they'll collapse.
Well, I don't know. I think it's a fair thing that it would just completely put them out of action, really, suddenly getting an emotion. A really strong emotion when they've had no emotions for ages. Or if you think about the entire process that they've been put under to be turned into Cybermen, then having any sort of memory back, or, you know, if they get any sort of residual memory of that.
Yes,
in there,
I suppose so.
No. I think it's a really good I think that's a really good weapon to use against the Cybermen, so I would disagree with you.
You had a few things you want to say about Douglas Canfield's direction, didn't you, Mark?
Yes, I do, indeed. I mean, the invasion is, if you don't mind me sounding like a soccer pundit, this is a top story.
It's a bit late to ask you to stop now, Mark, after 7 years.
This is a top story. I think it's right up there with your Androzanis, your Deaths, your Genesises. And I think one of the main reasons that it pushes so high and why it's so good is down to one person, I think that's Douglas Canfield. And his direction on this is just brilliant. You remember when we used to watch Secret Army and stuff together, and sometimes I'd just get carried away with the direction, wouldn't I? I'd be going, oh, look at that shot, look at that framing and stuff.
Yes.
And the Sweeney as well. There's a Sweeney episode, Thou Shalt Not Kill, from Series 2. It was the final story broadcast in that series. And it's that's directed by Douglas Canfield. Do you remember it, Doc? It's the one where it's the bank raid.
Yes.
And they're like, there's a car park opposite where all the Sweeney is stationed, and there's this bank raid going on. And I kept interrupting that to say, oh, look at that. That could be an album cover, that shot could. You know, just the way he frames people. And the way, because there's quite a lot of brutalist architecture around there, he was using like the lines of it to make really interesting frames, basically, with the people. And it's beautiful to behold. Some of it's absolutely art. And as I was watching this episode, I noticed there's a few examples from it in episode 6, about 13 and a half minutes in. There's this scene. It's immediately after we haven't seen the unit assault on the car. And so because they didn't have the time to film it, what you get is a scene with one of Vaughan's henchmen is telling the tale of what's happened. And that sequence opens with a huge close-up on this guy's face. And he's all sweaty and dishevelled and distressed. And just to the left and to the right of him, far back in the background, you just see a slightly blurry Packer on one side and Vaughan on the other. And then as he's talking, the blurry figure of Tobias Vaughan starts moving in the background to the right of the screen. And the camera moves around the head that it's got right in the foreground in sharp focus. And it follows the blurred image of Tobias Vaughan as he moves to the right, keeping the guy's head in frame at all times. It follows Vaughan right round to his table, gradually brings him into focus. And it's just lovely. It's just the way it's art. It's the way he keeps the camera moving. He makes, this could be just a quick throwaway scene, and yet he puts all this effort into plotting out camera move and the actors. And he follows it around. And, you know, that could have been a static shot with another director or, you know, cut to different faces when they're talking and stuff. But he doesn't at all, just keeps it on there like that. And it's lovely. And then there's a shot a little bit after that where everybody's talking to the doctor. And it's about 15 minutes in. And it's the bit you said about Doc, where Jamie's asleep and the doctor's discussing a plan. And it's just the way that that picture is framed as well. It's lovely. And then there's a scene at 1750 in episode 6, which opens on Tobias Vaughan stood in his office. Now, you've got the lines of the windows that he's looking out of. He's to one side. For some reason, he's right towards the left-hand side of the frame. He's got his foot up on, like, the window, on a low windowsill. And he's leaning, and it's a very almost exaggerated pose, but it looks great. He's gazing out at the city that he's going to be controlling. There's no reason for him to be there, because in a few seconds he's got to walk across and talk to the cyber director. And it just opens like that, and just took a screenshot of that frame. And it just looks like art. And like I say, it's just the way the lines are and everything. And that's even more prominent towards the end of the episode at 21 minutes 20, when the invasion's begun and that signal goes out and London is starting to fall. You said, Hayden, about the guy in the car with his head on the steering wheel and stuff. And all these scenes towards the end of episode 6 are just absolutely superb. But there's this one at 21 minutes and 20 seconds. There's a guy, he's right far away from the camera, and there's a wall.
It's just like the concrete honeycomb.
Yes, and there's like a concrete honeycomb wall that's stretching out in front of him towards us. And again, it's just beautifully framed. And he gradually walks closer and closer and closer towards us before collapsing, holding onto this honeycomb wall and sort of sliding down it. And it looks beautiful. And there's one more scene as well that I'd just like to share, which is a bit similar to the first one I mentioned. It's about halfway through episode 7, and it's where the Doctor is sat talking to Tobias Vaughan.
And the Doctor's sort of got his index fingers together, like, here's a church, here's a steeple.
Yeah, the Doctor's right in the foreground. He's taking up half of the frame. He's just so close up in shot. All you can see is his head, shoulders, and his fingers fiddling around. And he's peering forward or down. And just in the background, you can see Tobias Vaughan, again, over by his window. And he's out of focus. And he's looking in the opposite direction to the Doctor. And they're having a conversation. And they don't look at each other at all during these opening moments. And like I say, again, this could have been so easily just done like, oh, we go to the Doctor in the office talking to Vaughan. And it could have just been a very simple, sort of like, here's him talking, here's him talking, here's him talking. Here's... And it's done in such a way, it's had so much thought and creativity put into it. And I think that's what I'm getting at, is Douglas Canfield is just really creative with his camera photography and his direction of the cameras. And again, in this one, as Vaughan moves to the right again, round to his desk, the camera does that thing again where it gradually focuses in on him before he sits down. He's put a lot of work into that and a lot of effort and a lot of thought. And as I said, this is just a silly kids TV show to some people. He could just have been like, oh, yeah, whatever. But, you know, he put everything into these stories. And as you both quite rightly say, the big battle at the end between the military and the Cybermen, which is obviously very much in Douglas Canfield's, very much in his ballpark with his military background and his love of all things military. And those scenes, obviously, I haven't bothered giving you a time thing for it, because when the Cybermen are walking down the steps of walking towards you from with St. Paul's Cathedral in the background, and you just see their heads appearing over the stairs that are in front of you, it's iconic for a reason. You know, you could have framed it differently. You might not have framed it with the same sort of... Just wouldn't have been as effective. It wouldn't have hit as hard. It wouldn't have been quite so iconic. You see photographs as well, if you don't, you're doing the shoot, filming the Cybermen walking along the side of the pub, and there's the cameraman laid on the ground to get that low angle of the Cybermen, which makes them look even more threatening. And it's just stuff like that. Episode 6 packed full of it. It's an incredible episode. And it's just lovely to watch. And it's something I think that next time I rewatch it, I'll probably be looking out for even more of this stuff, because it just delights me. So Douglas Canfield, absolute directing royalty, really.
There's one last directorial screenshot you sent us, Mark. It was... Oh, sorry, it's just, look at this unit guy checking out Zoe's bum.
Yeah, see, that's art.
No, that's arse.
Oh dear.
I think we'll put together a montage of those clips that Mark's referred to in our YouTube channel so that you can watch along with them if you like. Links in the show notes as ever at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. We did ask our listeners on social media if they fancied sending in some views on the invasion. And we've had a few. The 42 to Doomsday boys have tweeted in saying, I remember the good old days when the copies we used to have had no linking or animation. In a weird sort of way, it still made sense. Great story, though a bit like Genesis of the Daleks, where the Cybermen are playing second fiddle to a mad genius. Oh, that's the point I made. James H. At FitGeek UK said, Vaughan is great, but why exactly do the Cybermen invade? And what does this do to the continuity of the 10th planet? That's a point. Neilers C, N-E-I-L-E-R-S-C, on Twitter said that a favourite story from the Troughton era, an absolute belter, a very fun adventure. Tobias Vaughan is a brilliant villain, and you can't forget that iconic shot of the Cybermen walking through London. It's one of the better animations as well. We've also got a comment from David Kitchen, but I think my voice is going, Mark. Could you read out David's tweet, please, Mark?
Certainly. I imagine David would say it like this. A favourite chapter.
and one of several great Cybermen stories from that era. The Invasion fills its episode count by making everything feel bigger than most stories. IE is a big company with multiple premises. Units are properly an international organization, and Russia is a part of the solution. And the attack is on the world, not just London. The Cybermen are used sparingly, but with enough numbers, it feels like an invasion.
Oh, God, I need a drink.
International Electromatics. It's a f***ing disgrace.
The villains are great. Unit is introduced by a crew who know how the military works, and it shows. A cracking adventure. An A from me. One Cyberman screamed his own larynx out. What a f***ing disgrace.
And we've also had a Facebook post from Johnny Dab, who says, "Hello, diddly dummers. Doctor Who The Invasion is a fantastic serial from an era with so many fantastic serials. With 8 episodes, you would expect it to drag, but it doesn't. Even though the mystery at the beginning is a little slow. But then there's the reunion with the Brigadier, who has had a promotion, which is at that time such a very cool callback. Kevin Stoney's Tobias Vaughan is magnetic to watch, he just steals every scene. Which is tough because the Cyber Controller is so very creepy. I do an impression of early Cybermen." Oh, right. "And I think it's based on the Cyber Controller. The actual Cybermen in this don't actually say or do that much. But in this case, less is more, as everything they do oozes with menace."
Yes.
"Oozes with menace, and the final confrontation is epic. My only gripe with this is that bloody awful Teddy Bear's Picnic tune that Isabel plays. It would be nice if it ends up in Room 101. This story is so a 10 out of 10 story, and is utterly fabulous. The animation for episode 1 and 4 is the first of all the animations of missing episodes, and I still feel it's one of the best. Only rivaled by the Macra Terror animation so far. But I do keep dreaming. One day the animations will be like watching the real thing. I once met Packer in the Royal Oak in Welshpool, the posh pub."
Packer?
"As we were leaving, my friend introduced him as my actor friend. We both said hello politely. I didn't work out who he was until I watched A for Andromeda, in which he is excellent. I am a bad fan sometimes. Yours, Johnny D." Right. Do we have any other comments? Or shall we give it a marks out of 10?
"Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
I would give it a 9.5.
Oh, we might have a snap there. I think 9.5 out of 10.
Ooh.
Do you know what? I prevaricated over this, whether or not to just to give it a straight 10. And is there any reason not to? I can't think.
Be brave, Mark. Be brave.
No, do you know what? I'll give it a 10. I loved it.
Whee.
Right, well, listeners, that's our view of The Invasion. Next week, the Whosium will be visited by friend of the show, Mr. Tony Jordan from the Dwas, who will be here to regale us with stories of the preparations for the coming Capital 6 convention in April. This is becoming a regular thing that we do every year in the run-up to Capital. We drag Tony on to talk to us about things. And, oh, what's this? Just, this stage, don't we usually get Uncle Terence coming down the corridor to wish us goodbye? Hang on. A secret panel's just opened in the corridor wall. Who's that behind it who's going to say goodbye to us? It's the Cyber Director.
"Do not dump bodies into the river."
I bet you'd let Tobias Vaughan dump whatever he liked into the river, wouldn't you?
"It has been agreed."
Cyber Director, I'm pointing this emotion machine at you.
"It's a trap."
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dumb Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumbpodcast.wordpress.com, on Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydumb, on iTunes at diddlydumbpodcast, on Twitter at diddly_dumb, or email us at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dumb. It is liquid podcasting. Fit it in your ear.